for our blind and print-impaired audience. Your North Carolina Reading Service brings you Indie Week, read by John Federson. And the current issue is December the 15th from 2020. And this week, performing on variable speed drills, the Fuquay Varina Dental Hygienists Chamber Music Club. They're experts with those drill bits. They will actually be offering me a complimentary cleaning after the broadcast by their Crocodile Bird Battalion. That's unless I successfully evade capture. Okay, on to the Indie Week. And there's a back talk, a letter to the editor about Tomasi McDonald's article last week about the Lumbee tribe's quest for federal recognition. Lumbee tribe member Emily Locklear of Chicago pointed out in a mail that plenty of documentation exists to verify Lumbee ancestry. She writes, Richard Sneed and the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians pathologically deny the Lumbee, but it is not because our claims are illegitimate or unverifiable, she wrote. No, it's because the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina poses an economic threat to the EBCI. The EBCI gained total recognition under the same exact circumstances in which the Lumbee tribe currently seek total recognition. That's right, an act of Congress. So for Richard Sneed to be quoted in North Carolina Tribes Clash on Recognizing Lumbees article as having said, quote, we didn't invent these rules and this process, but we played by the rules. We have respected the process. We expect other tribes to as well, is laughable. Because the Lumbee tribe is not only following the rules, we're following the rules the EBCI followed, to the T. EBCI believe that recognition through Congress is a viable option for them, and not the Lumbee. Even more interesting is when you consider the fact that they were silent when six tribes in Virginia were granted total recognition by acts of Congress as well. But since those nations' boundaries are in Virginia and have no gaming rights, they pose no financial threat. And then, at the end of the day, that's all this boils down to. Just ask the Catawba. The Lumbee are not asking for anything that isn't rightfully ours. As a matter of fact, it's the only thing we've been asking for since 1888. No matter how hard Richard Sneed and the EBCI attempt to manipulate Lumbee history in their repeatedly unsuccessful bids to legitimatize clear lies as truths, the Lumbee truth remains steadfast. It doesn't matter that Sneed's motivations are equal parts self-serving and questionable. The Lumbee tribe of North Carolina was acknowledged by the federal government in 1956 as inherently indigenous, and our seat at the table is long overdue. And it's ours by right. And I'll pass now to an op-ed article by Edward Rogers, a high school junior at Durham Academy, and it's called Future Block. Young people have endured a lot this year. At what is supposed to be the most exciting and promising time in our lives, so much turmoil has brought everything to a screeching halt. The pandemic has upended our high school, collegiate, and professional careers, and it has forced us to alter the life plans that we prepared. We've also witnessed the cruelest acts of racism across the nation and have stepped up to fight for racial equity on social media and in socially distanced protests. Fortunately, the recent 2020 election presented the opportunity for 18 to 29-year-olds to use their right to vote and decide the future of our country. It is such a valuable privilege, and never has the vote felt more consequential. Issues such as health care, racial wealth gap, student debt, and career outlook have immense impacts on our futures, especially now. Many of us have fought for the change we wish to see, but we must address the massive elephant in the room, Young people just do not vote. The question is, why? I'm currently a high school junior in Durham. While I was not old enough to vote this November, I worked for progressive political action locally and nationally by phone and text banking, holding voter registration drives, and organizing discussions with officials, such as Durham Mayor Steve Shule. Tufts University Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement reported 53% to 56% of eligible voters age 18 through 29 voted in this presidential election, which was around 10% higher than in 2016. This development is encouraging, but there is still a serious discrepancy between the number of young people that can and that do vote. Over the past several months, I've been trying to understand youth voter turnout. I want to share what I've learned so far. As a young person, one of the most frustrating misconceptions is that we do not care about politics. Adults too quickly dismiss our inaction for indifference. The truth is that we have an immense amount of passion, especially for social issues such as climate change, gun control, and racial equity, that directly affect our lives and futures. However, many of us feel jaded and disenfranchised by a system that was created by the wealthy and powerful and continues to ignore struggling communities. With a judicial and legislative system stacked against progressive change, a single vote can feel insignificant. A frustrating number of candidates simply adhere to this unjust system as it is, and do not seek to change it in any significant way. In addition, many young people feel that voting is so complicated that it isn't worth their time. Voters have to know where they will be during voting, choose their form of voting, and know where to go to the polls or drop off their ballot. Simple enough, right? Not for young people, who often balance jobs, school, family life, and other interests. Many states also abuse their power in determining voting regulation. Specifically in southern and rural areas, there is an immense amount of voter suppression, such as requiring specialized school IDs, proof of school enrollment, and proof of residency, not to mention long lines due to inadequate public infrastructure. All of these complications can make voting feel like too much effort. In many ways, the 2020 election was a showcase for why young people feel so jaded. Joe Biden's victory seemed like the bare minimum for people concerned with progressive platforms. In North Carolina, it was disappointing to see our state go red for President Donald Trump once again, due to the constant lying and abuse we have endured for 4 years. These results were very difficult for me to digest because I had been volunteering for Joe Biden's campaign here for months and all my work felt inconsequential. It was also frustrating to see Trump's ally, Senator Tom Tillis, win re-election, but not completely surprising after Cal Cunningham carelessly jeopardized his candidacy with an affair. It now seems likely the U.S. Senate will remain red and the U.S. House will barely remain blue. These results indicate that it will be very difficult to pass meaningful legislation that will help people during this crisis. As progressive young people, we have reached a frustrating standstill, so where do we go from here? For me, this election was a wake-up call. There is so much more to do to ensure that young people can fairly take advantage of their right to vote for progressive representation. I had naively thought that the paradigm would undergo a major shift in this election, but that was not to be. Change takes time and persistence. At this point, we must work toward action. Two pivotal Senate races are going into runoffs in Georgia, and there are also many more races coming up in 2022, including another U.S. Senate race in North Carolina. These upcoming races are exciting opportunities to enact more change in our state and the country. While it is hard to feel empowered to vote, when there is so much working against many of us, we must fight on. We need to use the injustices in our system as even more motivation to get involved. There's so much work to do on the local and federal levels to improve voting accessibility and equalize the system. We must also continue to inspire others in our close communities to visualize a more equitable, progressive future. If we can make it easier to vote and connect with people about why their vote can make a difference, we can change the paradigm. With nearly 40% of young people not using their right to vote, there's plenty of space for improvement. From Durham, Tomasi McDonald's column, Dead End. Pardon me. Days before he was fatally shot, Trevion Amerson had moved into a mustard-colored duplex in a troubled neighborhood just south of downtown Durham. Police have been tight-lipped about the circumstances of the shooting after reporting that Amerson, 23, was mortally wounded on November the 24th, in the middle of the day, inside of his newly rented home on Dawkins Street in the city's Haiti district. Some people who were on Dawkins Street that day said they saw two ambulances arrive in the neighborhood and thought multiple people had been shot. The sight wasn't out of the ordinary. In September, police charged a 17-year-old with shooting three people in the neighborhood. Neighbors later found out that about the same time that Amerson was shot, someone had overdosed near the stand of bamboo trees behind the duplex. The dual incidents highlight an interconnected web of issues, including drugs and gun violence, plaguing the compact Dawkins Street area in particular, and parts of the black and brown community in the city more broadly, due primarily to long-standing racial and economic inequity that city leaders say is being aggravated by fallout from the pandemic. Hassan Saleh works across the street from Amerson's duplex at a halfway house for formerly incarcerated men. He also works in maintenance and had readied the apartment where Amerson had lived for 2 days. The next day he was dead, Sully told the Indy. Sully, a 63-year-old lifelong Durham resident who works as a peer specialist at the halfway house, said the overdose victim found behind the duplex was the 12th case in the area in recent weeks, owing to a bad batch of drugs circulating in the neighborhood. It's like every two or three every week, he said, of the overdoses. I mean, it's really gotten out of control. Police last week reported that gun violence, long a problem in the Bull City, has also been spiraling out of control in recent weeks. Durham reached a dismal plateau this year, with well over 800 reported shootings. The police department's crime analysis unit reports that by November 28th, there were already 882 shootings this year, with 291 people struck by gunfire. Last year during the same period, there were reports of 615 shootings and 179 people shot. Police spokeswoman Cammy Michael told the Indy last week, the number of shootings to date is the highest since the Durham police started compiling this information in 2016. On November the 12th, Mayor Steve Shewell and Police Chief Carolyn Davis hosted a late-morning press conference to address the rising tide of gun violence after a drive-by shooting killed a 15-year-old boy, Anthony Adams, on East Main Street, not far from the other side of the Durham Freeway and Dawkins Street. Shewell said Durham's, quote, very tough few months of gun violence is part of a national trend exacerbated by COVID-19. The city was already challenged by a proliferation of illegal guns, but the pandemic, he said, is now fueling out-of-control gun sales, while further igniting the always volatile illegal drug trade and gang activity. He said, the virus has heightened the factors that lead to gun violence. Unemployment, housing instability, hunger, mental health problems, and isolation. He listed four strategies to combat gun violence: smart, effective policing, reliance on community resources, legislative action, and addressing the root causes of the issue. And he said, if a person has a good job that pays good wages with affordable health care, a good school for their kids, and an affordable, safe, warm home to lay their heads every night, they are not going to be committing gun violence or dealing drugs or joining gangs. We've got to attack the root causes or we won't end gun violence in our city or our society. Davis, the police chief, said that one effective strategy has been the consolidation of the department's violent crimes task force. Instead of assigning its investigators to separately probe violent crimes for each district, she said, they're working closer together to connect various crimes that are being committed in the city and also connecting the individuals who are participating in the incidents. That includes not just sharing within the department, but with our community, state, and federal partners. Police reported so far there have been 34 homicides this year, compared with 32 in 2019. The good news is the city probably will not exceed bloody 2016 when they investigated 42 homicides. The most recent murder was the December 9 shooting death of Cedric Dion Bowens on the 3000 block of Fayetteville Street near Chicken Hut. During the press conference, Chief Davis said it cannot go unnoticed that the majority of the city's gun offenders are also juveniles, noting that the department had recently cleared 10 shooting cases. And she said 4 of those cases were cleared by arrest, and the incidents were committed by 2 juveniles. Shule said the pandemic has removed structures from young people's lives that offer them constructive outlets. And he said, teens who are normally in school are spending time at home because of the pandemic, or they are out on the streets or under the influence of the streets. He also noted that the city's Parks and Recreation Department normally offers major on-site programs that are impossible to operate during the pandemic. The onset of the winter season without school or constructive recreation outlets in the city has been deadly. Amerson was one of 5 people fatally shot between November 1st and December 1st, police reported. The victims included 15-year-old Adams on November 8th and Keith Kennedy, 46, on Meriwether Drive in November 21st. On November 25th, one day after Amerson was shot and the day before Thanksgiving, local ABC affiliate WTVD reported chaos erupting at Liberty and Railroad Streets at about 7:30 p.m., when more than 10 gunshots rang out from the occupants of 2 opposing cars. One of the drivers was fatally shot, and his car veered out of control and hit 5 pedestrians, including a child. There have been several fatal shooting deaths since, including the December 1 murder of Jelani Whittington, 37, not far from where 15-year-old Adams died. Saleh and his work partner, Bernard Sibenge, cleaned the apartment where Amerson died. Photos that Sibenge took of the shooting scene show an oblong, salmon-shaped reservoir of dark blood that curdled on the dark wooden floor near the front door of the duplex, and Saleh told the Indy he must have answered the door and got shot. Investigators late last week had not announced an arrest in the case, nor have they disclosed a motive for the fatal shooting. The shooting of young black men by their peers here in Durham and across the nation has become so commonplace. Some have become numb to their deaths, or even worse, to paraphrase the poet Ntozake Shange, they accept young black men's death as casually as morning coffee. Amerson was not without his share of personal troubles. State corrections records show that he had just been released from prison on October 5, 2019, after he was sentenced to a little over 2 years behind bars for common law robbery. Amerson's family loved him, especially his mother, Felicia, a devout Christian woman. She could not be reached for comment, but the words she shared on social media echo the brokenness felt by parents who have lost their children to gun violence. She wrote last week, "This pain will never go away in my heart. I can't come to the reality that my baby is gone. I've cried so much that my tears simply won't come out." She said words failed to express the pain she was feeling. "I will never be the same," she wrote. Dawkins Street, just off Umstead Street and a short walk from Hillside Park may be the city's most troubled neighborhood. The short block is ridden with homelessness, gang activity, drugs, violence, sex work, and the callousness that sometimes grows over the repeatedly rejected ambitions of the most impoverished and marginalized. On cold nights, folks without a home gather around a 55-gallon drum in an open field next to the halfway house. They take wooden pallets from a nearby pile and burn them in the rusted drum to stay warm. The police regularly patrol the area, and there have been community-based efforts to help. As previously reported in Indy, the nearby Harriet Tubman YWCA building was given new life a little over a year ago when the nonprofit Reinvestment Partners purchased the property. The organization wants to build affordable housing on the site, possibly with a daycare center. The neighborhood halfway house features a community garden. Volunteers with North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition regularly arrive to hand out packets of food and information. Last week, a trio of volunteers offered information about free COVID testing and an alert about a new shelter that's open during white flag nights when temperatures drop below freezing. Before leaving, the volunteers walked through the neighborhood and picked up used discarded syringes. Sally says some people addicted to heroin and crack cocaine will show up and stay on the streets for days getting high. And he said, I asked one woman, how are you staying warm? It gets cold out here at night. And she said, oh, I can do the cold. I saw her this week, and she sounds like she has walking pneumonia. Man, walking pneumonia can kill you, but that's the insanity of addiction. And Sibengu calls Dawkins Street the worst area in Durham for drugs. He said, on a normal day, people will walk up, put the dope in your hand and ask you, what do you want? The impoverishment in the Dawkins Street area is arguably a root cause of its violence. Salih said, a lot of prominent people used to live on Umstead Street. Now it's a tale of two cities in our little town. There's a lot of haves and a whole lot of have-nots. We move over to another news column from Alamance County called Alamance Dam, and it's written by Eric Ginsburg. Tom Boney Jr. just wanted to do his job, but when Boney, the white-haired publisher of the conservative-leaning Alamance News, tried to cover a local court case, the judge demanded that he leave. Moments later, bailiffs cuffed the bespectacled publisher and forced him out of the building. They weren't gentle about it either. We've been watching heavy-handed and racist law enforcement practices unfolding publicly in Alamance County for years now. In 2020, it's become the state's epicenter of unbridled white supremacist rage, as well as the site of massive and persistent resistance to that status quo. Given this backdrop, it's hard not to see Alamance Chief District Court Judge Fred Wilkins' decision to bar Boney and reporters from Triad City Beat and the News and Observer from his courtroom as a reactionary act of state repression aimed at further squelching the First Amendment. It cannot and must not stand. Indy Week condemns Judge Wilkins' totalitarian decree. We stand fully behind our fellow journalists' objection to his decision, and we also fully support their petitioning to open court proceedings to the public and press. We insist on open courtrooms as a basic and fundamental tenet of democracy. We also denounce what appears to be an emerging pattern of stifling dissent, as well as attempts to report on it. Attacks on a free press, whether visited on a conservative outlet like Alamance News or a progressive one like Indy, are unacceptable threats to a free society. Here's a little context on how the hell we got to this point. This year, the central North Carolina county, located between Durham and Greensboro, consistently grabbed national and international headlines for its treatment of anti-racist protesters. Law enforcement, both in notorious Alamance County Sheriff's Department and the Graham Police, have repeatedly come under fire for what appear to be brazen attempts to stifle demonstrations. Then a district attorney decided to get in on the action, pressing what looked like a retaliatory felony charges against a reverend leading some of the protests. Now, the court system has one-upped them all, with an Alamance judge banning several reporters from documenting proceedings in his courtroom. The most damning part of all is that these attacks on the First Amendment, both the constitutional rights to free speech and assembly, as well as freedom of the press, are happening in broad daylight and despite heightened media attention. When locals started gathering regularly at the base of a massive Confederate monument in the heart of downtown Graham earlier this year, Sheriff Terry Johnson's department tried to stop granting people protest permits altogether, no matter the size, type, or time, quote, for the foreseeable future. In October, standing alongside Graham police, his deputies pepper-sprayed marched to the polls participants on the last day of early voting. Following international outcry, Johnson's office pursued felony charges against Reverend Greg Drumright, the march's organizer, seeming to intentionally distort his public statements to make it sound like the Reverend wanted to incite a riot. Soon after, Drumright led hundreds in a peaceful march in Alamance County. Graham police reportedly refused to provide an escort. Activists have repeatedly decried law enforcement's apparent coziness with the far right in Alamance County. Neo-Confederate groups and avowed white supremacists have repeatedly gathered at the Confederate monument, heckling anti-racists, shouting white power from passing cars, and sometimes getting physical. To anti-racist protesters, especially black and brown Alamance County residents, it feels like the state is aligned with these extremists. Photos of Sheriff Johnson's fraternal interactions with neo-Confederate agitators don't exactly dispel this notion. Repression in Alamance extends to the press. During that October 31st march to the polls, police forcefully arrested a reporter with the Alamance News. Then on December 8, as reporters attempted to cover a related court proceeding in Alamance County Court, Judge Wilkins barred them from attending. Alamance News publisher Boney told Triad City Beat what happened when he entered the courtroom. "Be quiet," Judge Wilkins reportedly said. "Get out of this courtroom. This courtroom is not closed to the public. It is closed to you." Bailiffs cuffed Boney and, quote, "They were really quite rough and claimed I was resisting when they were twisting my arm," he told Triad City Beat. The three newspapers filed a formal objection with the court, requesting, quote, "access to all future proceedings." That's especially paramount as several protesters' cases head to court soon. Unfortunately, these assaults on the First Amendment don't shock us. They grow from a pattern of racist abuse in law enforcement, apparent in Johnson's past comments about Mexicans and efforts to squash anti-Confederate protests in Alamance dating back at least several years. If this is how white reporters are treated, just imagine the kinds of justice Alamance County's black and brown residents receive from the legal system when nobody is looking. Change is coming to Alamance County. This year, a grassroots campaign buoyed Democrat Ricky Hurtado, the son of Salvadoran immigrants and an instructor at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to victory for a state House seat over his conservative opponent. Anti-racist protests led by Drumright and others show no signs of abating. That towering Confederate monument, if not removed and relocated by authorities, will one day fall, crashing to the ground as its counterpart did in Durham. And journalists, no matter how many times they're locked up or shut out, will continue to show up and report the news. That's the thing about state repression. It often boomerangs into more resistance. Throw bogus charges against a protest leader and you'll likely draw dozens more to their cause. enforce the law unequally, and the ACLU and others will sue you and win. Shut reporters out of your courtroom and ensure more journalists arrive next time. We don't know the motivations of Sheriff Johnson, the Alamance County District Attorney, the Graham Police Chief, or Judge Wilkins. Repressing the First Amendment might not be their aim. But regardless of intent, an opaque justice system can only serve to uphold the racial, economic, and political hierarchies in Alamance County. Like it or not, change is on the way. And we move on into our arts and culture columns. And the first one, fairly long, in fact, it's the cover story, from David Ford Smith, the columnist. Southern Fried Funk is titled. In a sense, Boulevard's new EP, Brother, began with a light reset. It was late 2019, and Jameel Rashad was doing what musicians do, firing off a barrage of email demos out to labels and industry connections, working out his next career steps. A veteran of the rough and tumble 2010s American music underground, the Raleigh native had already achieved a degree of success as his longtime neo-funk alter ego, Boulevards. Some in his position would rest on their former clout and allow their music career to fall off into history, or put out the occasional Back to Basics record every few years. But Rashad, a preternaturally ambitious guy and born performer, has always played the game harder than that. Up to that point, his music has charted a path through the slick, nocturnal ambience and jittery rhythms of classic electro-funk. Bold and brash and stridently pro-black, his music was inextricably tied to the ostentatious fashion and car-rattling synthesized sounds of the 70s, like Confunction, Rick James, Funkadelic, etc. His embodiment of that era was apparent to anyone who saw him light up a stage, and his aura screamed that he knew where the after-party was and was probably playing it. Rashad says, "My father and his crew of people put me on clothing. Though I love denim, and I mean I love denim. I could sleep in it if I wanted to. It wasn't even about all this fashion stuff at the beginning. Learning from the old head dudes, it was more about having confidence as a black man, feeling your identity in that." A number of collaborators in the wider indie electrosphere have helped throw magic dust on his profile. On 2017's Hurt Town, USA, he collaborated with Alan Palomo from synth-funk revivalists Neon Indian on the track New Burn Avenue. And just earlier this year, he dropped a burner called Too Far with bulletproof synth-pop singer Ellie Jackson, a.k.a. LaRue, whom he tells me he met through friends. It might seem like a bit of subterfuge, then, that Rashad's new EP, Brother, is dropping December 18th via the label Normal Town Records, an imprint of the Americana alternative country label New West Records. As Rashad tells it, the idea wasn't to toss all his synths out the window and knee-jerk rewire his sound in a cynical way, but instead to move slowly and organically toward an earthier floor, something rawer. The move was preordained, perhaps, as Boulevard toured extensively last year with Orville Peck, the Canadian noise rock drummer turned country music sensation. As Rashad sees it, it was a natural evolution for what he calls his Southern Fried Punk Funk. And he says, "I'm really excited about New West because they provide what I want from a label, trust, growth, and evolution. I still rock with the synthesized funk stuff I was doing, but I just knew I had to come with music that showed progression, that I could tangle with the solo country acts right now, the crossover indie acts, and do it on my own terms. Some bands have these giant industry machines behind them that you never see, making their decisions, And the last few years, a lot of my career investments have come out of literally just me building with people, investing money from my own pocket, whether from records, touring income, whatever. It's good to be working with industry people I trust. Breezy and Sun-Kissed Love and Pain, the first single from Brother, isn't a total departure from the Midnight Cruise music of his earlier releases. The funk is still there, but the BPMs are pared back, landing somewhere between vintage 70s pomp and the genre-hybrid placement-friendly soul of recent indie stars like Kaorang Bin or Unknown Mortal Orchestra. As he explains it, the song is a classic tale of self-sabotage in relationships. And he says, in relationships, you can have that resentment to the other person or even towards yourself for giving them that power. That person loves you, and he can also drop you off the effing wall. He credits his morphing sound to the production chops of Chicago-based soul production maestro Blake Ryan. Ryan is best known as the creative force behind the popular soul outfit Durand Jones and the Indicators, though he also works doing research for the esteemed reissued label Numero Group. Smitten with the band, Rashad connected with him over social media. Right around the time when they started cooking up music together, travel became impossible, so the pair started cobbling together tracks for Brother through internet channel, becoming music geek buddies in the process. He's the man. Rashad says, I love working with guys who are real nerds about their craft, who can put me on to crazy 60s stoner motorcycle metal, innovative leisure reissues, all that. Blake is that person for me. He instantly got what I was trying to do. Though a lot of the material came together even before the groundswell of this summer's BLM protests, Rashad's status as a politically minded black artist working in the predominantly white frame of indie rock means that a lot of the themes on the record speak to his experiences. The very usage of the word brother as the EP title is an intentional exclamation point on this. And he says the song Shook is specifically about being afraid of police officers, whether in Raleigh, New York, or L.A. As a black man, he says, I have to calculate my every move when I leave the house. That's something I needed to talk about and share. He says he's not looking to shout down people about his message, though. I didn't want to do it in a preachy way, he says. I wanted to do it like Sly or Curtis Mayfield did, in a way that people of all colors could listen to and relate to. The partnership with New West certainly feels like a good fit for him, a situation less prone to the hype-driven business demands that had somewhat dictated his early career. Early in Boulevard's rise, he had linked up with influential New York City indie emporium Captured Tracks, which was better known for scuzzy guitar acts like Mac DeMarco and DIIV. For a 2015 self-entitled EP and Groove, a 2016 full-length. The label was trying to branch out and snapped him up, but common label marketing and interpersonal issues conspired against their partnership. And Rashad said, Captured Tracks thing didn't work out, but it's all love. Those are my people. Some of it was writing issues, not agreeing on the way my projects were handled in that high-pressure environment, but shoot, some of it was me. At the time, I was out partying a lot. Whiling, because I was still so new in the indie music scene. I had to get my ego in check, and sometimes you need those humbling experiences. With no touring on the horizon for now, Rashad tells me he misses it with a passion. But as evidenced by the appearance of this EP, he also makes it clear that he is not going to sit on unreleased music for years in the interest of a hypothetical tour marketing push. The unfortunate wait-and-see game that many indie artists seem to be playing at the moment. He's staying busy and sane in Raleigh, studiously plugging away on a full-length album, potentially for release next year. He says, Making this music is exactly what's keeping me happy. Once, during a 2015 RBMA lecture, George Clinton was asked point blank what funk means. Funk, Clinton said, is anything you needed to be to save your life at the time. That sounds about right for Boulevards, who, amid shifting life and label circumstances, continues to put out a diverse, ever-evolving spread of tunes. The funk always comes with them. And next, from Will Atkinson in Music, Homegrown Streaming. If you spent any time on social media on the first day of December, there's a good chance you ran into a Spotify Wrapped, or perhaps several dozen. This aggregation of listening habits, tailored to the individual user and presented in sleek Instagram-ready graphics, has been something of a yearly ritual in the age of streaming, as our music consumption is increasingly dominated by massive platforms like Spotify. There's no doubt that it's fun to analyze your own year in music and compare it with others. Yet the unveiling of Spotify Wrapped each December also serves as a reminder of streaming's stranglehold on the music industry, an arrangement that makes it difficult, and some musicians say nearly impossible, for independent musicians to earn revenue from their recorded work. Tracks Music Library, launched in the spring, offers a locally focused alternative. Formed as a collaboration between the Chapel Hill Public Library and Chapel Hill Community Arts and Culture, the streaming platform exclusively features music by local artists who are compensated for their submissions and given full ownership of their tracks. Upon visiting the website, you can search curated music from more than 70 musicians and bands. If you have a Chapel Hill Library card, you can also download music. Early in December, first on its own platform and a few days later on other platforms, Trax capped off its first year with the release of two compilations, Trax Volume 1, We Rise as Allies, and Trax Volume 2, Isolation Illumination, with a roster of local artists that run the gamut from hip-hop to jazz and from indie to bluegrass. The projects offer artists a chance to respond to the twin crises that have marked this moment in America, the country's reckoning with systemic racism and the isolation of the pandemic. Melissa Bartoletta, Marketing and Communication Coordinator for Chapel Hill Community Arts and Culture, says, "Our main goal was to support local music. So we were like, what way can we do this but put money back into the pockets of these artists?" Working with producers Kevin Kays Thomas and Tom Canova, the library recruited artists to work on original songs and commissioned visual artists Chris Fresina and Cassidy Goff to design each album cover. We Rise as Allies, produced by Kays with art by Fresina, directly references the summer's Black Lives Matter protests, while Isolation Illumination, produced by Canova with art by Goff, is inspired by the experience of pandemic quarantine. The first track on We Rise as Allies, Can't Say Nothing, opens with a challenge from Kays to white observers of the moment of the movement for racial justice. Are you really my ally? Do you really care, or do you just feel guilty for being indifferent? Violet Bell's Lizzie Ross follows that spoken introduction with a frank admission of her own privilege as a white woman, singing, "I never have to fear blue lights in the rearview mirror. He leans in the window and says, 'Ma'am, you're free to go.'" And Thomas says, "I felt it was important to have that moment at the beginning to say, 'Hey, this is a conversation we need to have.' If you're in this moment and you don't know what to say or don't know what side of it you're on, it's time to have this conversation. It's uncomfortable, but let's start having it." From there, We Rise as Allies yields the floor to black voices. On Good Trouble, Kays rappers Rowdy and Dasan Ahanu and singer Nathan Harris trade verses, inspired by the late John Lewis and past generations of activists and ancestors. The uplifting jazz anthem Winner in You follows, and it sounds as if pianist and singer Lydia Sollett Dudley is responding directly to the verses that precede her. "Keep up your head, young man," she sings. "Don't you give up the fight." The compilation also includes genre-bending songwriter Sonny Miles, who counts Barack Obama among his fans, and the atmospheric soul of XOXOX, who closes out the volume with the tender love ballad All In. Now, for the second volume, Isolation Illumination, Tom Canova aimed to highlight the creative ingenuity that spending more time at home can foster. Without the ability to play live or record with others in a studio, he notes, home recording has become more important for artists than ever. He says people get to spend extra time during this isolation working on their track. And what this does for people who get to listen to it is it illuminates what artists are doing on their own during this crazy, crazy time. I think that hearing what artists have to say right now while we're all stuck at home is a good way to do it, because we can't go see them live and get the full effect. Isolation Illumination spans alt-country, electronic indie, and punk, featuring contributions from Shells, Pretend Chess, Ghost Guns, and Bangs, plus a stomping old-time instrumental from Durham's Hard Drive. While less overtly political than We Rise as Allies, the compilation still makes room for the moment. Bangs, scorching cut, love, calls us to make way for radical love, navigating a divided political climate with compassion. Like the music library itself, the tracks compilations seek to represent the full diversity of music in North Carolina. In the absence of the venues, studios, and clubs that normally form a scene, it can be difficult to see a clear path forward for that regional legacy. One of the great paradoxes of the pandemic is that we are at once more confined to our physical communities and more disconnected from them. In a way, Trax fills that vacuum, providing a virtual space for local music in the absence of a physical one. But even before the onset of the pandemic, the need for a local approach to streaming was there, notes Molly Luby, the Chapel Hill Public Library Special Projects Coordinator, who helped secure the state grants that funded the first year of Trax. Luby says, "So much music these days is streaming. And for a lot of local artists, it's very difficult to get their material in the library because they don't produce CDs. They're not necessarily part of the larger music ecosystem where we can order their music in the traditional ways that we've done at the library." She says, however, that Trax isn't simply an archive. It's a living document. "It will grow and change along with the music of Chapel Hill. It is something that is of the moment." From Elizabeth Cotton to Merge Records, Chapel Hill has long been a cradle for the musical legacy of North Carolina. Kays, reflecting on his own career in the local scene, says he doesn't expect that to change, and Trax is one reason why. And he says, "I think that we are the most talented musical community in our country. I do. Nashville is cool, don't get me wrong. Atlanta's cool, New York's cool, LA's cool. But the sauce comes from Carolina, baby. I don't care where you go, that sauce is going to come from Carolina. It's going to be in the mix, and the world loves it." And still in music, Brian Howe and Will Atkinson provide us with three reviews of local releases. And Brian Howe's first is Object Hours, Peace Goods, from Rosewater Recordings, out December 11th. This local supergroup features guitarist Nora Rogers of Solar Halos, guitarist Jenny Waters of Work Clothes and drummer Harrison Haynes of Hellbender and Les Savifav. On their debut, Peace Goods, the low-end Evacuation makes their measured, majestic instrumental rock feel at once heavy and ethereal, as if chiseled on the faces of storm clouds. Much closer in spirit to the meteorological metal of Solar Halos than the indie pop moonbeams of Work Clothes or the post-punk tantrums of Les Savifav, Peace Goods is a hazy monolith of guitar fog and squall, neatly squared off at the corners by the meticulous Haynes. Turning Point is a huge, greased bolt of implacable rock energy, while Fear-Based Excellence gets some of the old Les Savifav disco jitters into the mix. The delay pedal theatrics on the bright, growling street scene are the exception to the rule. This is not an effects-driven record. The band maintains a tight focus on the serpentine coil and churn of considered guitar grooves. Recorded by Chris Hilbert at the Fidelitorium, Peace Goods came out on December 11th in both digital and limited edition vinyl formats. The tracks range between 7 and 10 minutes apiece, sweeping vertiginous shadows over rugged landscapes with a hypnotic consistency that only occasionally flags into monotony. Creating tension without a bassist is a high wire act without a high wire, and Object Hours spends most of this epic EP adeptly hovering in midair. And Brian Howe gives Object Hours Peace Goods 3.5 stars. Also released December 11th from Second Wave, Corners, Paths, Noise. This review by Brian Howe again. Last month, Maison Fauna released Field Guide Volume 1, a compilation that staked out the Durham electronic label's musical terrain, house, techno, and UK garage. Its mission to curate local producers alongside like-minded souls from around the world, and its vibe of stylish, humane hedonism. It also served as a roadmap of potential future releases, one of which became real on December 11th with the release of Second Wave's vivid new EP, Corners, Paths, Noise. Second Wave is the project of Simon Briggs, the most cerebral of the Maison Fauna founders. His contribution to Field Guide, Flood Cove, was an entrancing minimal house caress with a surprisingly hearty bass line. He develops that contrast between placid surface and subterranean mobility here. Worlds We Create encapsulate Maison Fauna's house style of unorthodox UK garage, in which Briggs draws up to the edge of ambient music. He wrangles spirochetes of melody, ticking cymbals and knocking kicks into a ruffled 4/4 time, then fills it with dewy pads and ghostly sprays of kalimba, which all tightens into propulsive formation like a school of fish at the graceful drop. The thumb piano lingers through Vanish, tattooing billowing chords and deep house vocal bends, while harp runs scintillate through Wade. And Tobacco Trail is the pure UGK peak, infested with insectile arpeggios and slathered with mooing bass. Briggs' music is distinctly tactile, both aqueous and airy, but the dreamlike atmosphere courses with alert, intelligent gestures. Corners, Paths, Noise plunges his history in Chicago ambient circles into the welter of contemporary Durham, where the likes of Tree City and Foot Rocket and Collapse, all Field Guide contributors, mingle far-flung strains of electronic music without concern for the rules. A fine, deeply felt work in itself, it's also a pitch-perfect expression of Maison Fauna's steadily blooming Boutique with Heart brand. And this is also given 3.5 stars. And finally, from Will Atkinson's review of Said Deep, Duck in Idaho, came out on October the 23rd. Just before MP3s and file sharing became ubiquitous, The 1990s marked a heyday for a certain strain of vinyl sampling turntablist. Armed with Akai MPC samplers and enviable record collections, artists like DJ Shadow and the Avalanches assembled entire albums from samples alone. Bricolages of forgotten LPs, dusty drum breaks, and disembodied spoken word. 20 years later, it's no surprise that the Avalanches, whose 2000 album, Since I Left You, is considered a high watermark of sample-based music, has experienced something of a second life. As so much of our world goes digital, there's a renewed craving for the analog experience these artists represent. Sayed Deep is the project of Durham's Hank Stockard, an avid vinyl collector who grew up listening to those early icons of sampling. Duck in Idaho, his first release on the Roundhouse label, is his love letter to the form. Produced almost exclusively with records Stockard acquired from thrift store bargain bins and record shops across the Southeast. But even if its aim is inherently nostalgic, Duck in Idaho doesn't fall into rote imitation. What makes sampling so exciting as an art form, after all, is that the permutations are quite literally endless. As long as there are sounds, there will always be new and interesting ways to manipulate them. Of course, it takes a good DJ to actually do this well, and like its forebears, Duck in Idaho is at its best when it takes two or more seemingly disparate ideas and, against all odds, make them work together. Flay Your Flesh, for example, pairs a prayer-like vocal mantra with horror movie strings and a stabbing bass line to produce one of the most dance floor-ready tracks on the album. My Damn Self builds its pulse around the ha-ha-has of Laurie Anderson's experimental hit, Oh Superman. And I'll have to curtail this article, but its conclusion, Since I Left You was a raucous celebration of sampling's potential, then Duck in Idaho is the sound of the after-party winding down, moving from room to room as snatches of conversation float in and out of earshot. And it's given 3.5 stars by Will Alkinson. Well, here come the dental hygienists, and they're coming in with the pliers to open me up for the crocodile birds. So I'll have to bid farewell from Indie Week for this week, and for the next 2 weeks, I will not be in, as the studios are going to be closed. And you can hear this broadcast on our podcast section at ncreadingservice.org. And I hope to see you in the new year. And have a good holidays, everybody.